The following is a 1250 WTMA special presentation.
This is John Quincy, welcoming you to another edition of the History of TMA. As we take a break from the regular thing we do on the radio and remember some of the people and programming that have made up WTMA 70 plus years on the air in Charleston.
WTMA, Tiger Radio.
This hour, we're going from the 50s to the 80s as we talk to some of the DJs who spun records on this station. That's right, DJs and records. As WTMA was a music station up until June of 1989 when we switched to our current news talk format. First up, Red Evans, a Charleston native who joined the WTMA staff in the mid-50s while still a student.
When I was going to the College of Charleston, a friend of mine was a weekend disc jockey at WTMA, and he had to go into service. He was drafted. So he sort of turned the job over to me, and I had to get rid of my Charleston brogue to take the job, but I did, and stayed in broadcasting after that, although I was studying chemistry and math at the College of Charleston at the time.
So WTMA was the first station you worked for?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what year would this be?
1953 or 54. I think that's right.
Okay, what was WTMA doing on the air at that time?
They were playing pop music. They were a so-called Top 40 station.
I don't think it was called Top 40 at that time, but...
Well, yeah, Top 40, and they were playing the so-called good music, sort of a mixture of Top 40 and good music. They had a rhythm and blues show on at night, late at night at 11 o'clock, with Jack Gale, called the Hound Dog Show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But by and large, they were a Top 40 station.
And who else was working there when you started?
Bill Walton, Jack Gale. I think Bill Evenson was working there when I first went there. Of course, I was only working on the weekend, and I was a college kid. I mean, I couldn't find my rear end with both hands around a radio station. But Bill Walton taught me pretty much everything I needed to learn in terms of cleaning up my voice, getting rid of the Charleston accent, and so forth and so on.
So what was radio like there from a technical standpoint? I guess that was before the tape era when you started?
Yeah, all of the commercials were on disc. We were using some reel-to-reel tape at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Not much, but some. But most all of the commercials were on disc, and otherwise they were read live, including old Red with his heavy Charleston brogue. I was pretty bad. I can tell you that.
So how long were you at WTMA?
Well, at that time, I worked there a year, finished school, then went to work at a radio station in Beaufort, South Carolina. That was my first full-time broadcast job. It didn't last but about a month. That was the first broadcast job I got. Then I went to Tallahassee, Florida, and spent 3 years down there at a radio station. I did the night show. We had four radio stations on the air. I'm very proud to say that three of them shared 15% of the audience, and I had the other 85%.
Wow.
On a night show in a drive-in restaurant called the Dixieland Drive-In, and it was fun.
Speaking of big ratings at that time, WTMA was...
They were the hottest station probably in South Carolina, I'm sure of it.
Makes you wonder why nobody else was trying to do Top 40 radio at the time.
Well, WTMA was innovative back then. The Jack Gale show at 11 o'clock was very innovative. I mean, it was rhythm and blues of the back then would have been called the most gross in the world. I mean,
race
really
music,
was.
Right?
Yes. I mean, it was the whole nine yards. And of course, Jack Gale was white. He was a hot jock. He really was. He had the audience.
When did you come back to WTMA?
Well, let's see. I spent 3 years in Tallahassee. I came back to Charleston, worked at WOKE for a couple of years, Wonderful Woke Radio, with Harry Weaver, at which time I recorded that promo he used for the next 25 years. In fact, when I came back to Charleston in 1993, they were still using it. It was a recording that went, "This is Wonderful Woke Radio, Charleston's number two radio station. We must be number two. All the others are number one."
Oh, I must have heard that 100 times.
Oh, yeah, I'm telling you. And I recorded that back then. So anyway, I worked there for about 3 years, then went to Spartanburg, South Carolina, worked up there 4 or 5 years, came back. Let's see, when I came back from Spartanburg, I went to work at WTMA then. That was when I came back to WTMA. And, of course, I was full-time then. And I did a drive-in show in the old Target drive-in for Joe Lebelski.
Which was where?
On Rivers Avenue, just above Remount. Anyway, I did that show for a number of years at TMA.
Was that every night?
Yes, 5 days a week. It was a drive-in show. We had a glassed-in booth over the parking lot, and I could sit up there and play the records and carry on. We took requests and the whole thing.
So you actually played the music from the drive-in?
Yes, played it from the drive-in.
Commercials as well?
Commercials and all.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had my own stack of cartridges. Had to carry them out there and load them up, what have you, while I was playing the music. And I used to pantomime the record. My favorite was was Marty Robbins' El Paso. That was a lot of fun. For a young guy, doing a drive-in DJ show is absolutely more fun than anything you can think of. You know, the girls are there and everybody's having a grand time. I'll tell you a quick story about the days in Tallahassee. We didn't have this happen in Charleston, unfortunately, but it snowed one time in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, now, snow is not as rare as you might think, but in Tallahassee, Florida, 8 inches of snow is the rarest kind. The town went bananas. I mean, they just went crazy. So I was on the air at the drive-in, the Dixieland drive-in, and I thought, let's have a promotion here, and I just dreamed this up off the top of my head and said I would give a couple of record albums, and I couldn't tell you what the albums were, to whoever brought the biggest snowman to the drive-in restaurant. Believe it or not, it captured the imagination of Tallahassee, Florida. Now, why, I don't know, but people started driving into that drive-in restaurant with a snowman on top of their cars and their trucks, and it got so bad the highway patrol had to come out and control traffic on Monroe Street, which was right in front of the drive-in, and everything else like that. And the winner was a fraternity from Florida State University, from FSU, that drove in with a Ford station wagon with a 10-foot snowman on the back combined with the tailgate. And it weighed so much they had almost the entire fraternity brothers sitting on the hood to hold the front end of the car down while they drove that snowman to the Dixieland drive-in.
Wow.
I mean, it was wild. It was just wild.
All for just a couple of record albums.
All for a couple of record albums. We had a scavenger hunt once, and one of the items was a goat. I said, whoever brings a billy goat. I was just cutting up. I mean, I was crazy. I was a wild man. They call me the rockin' redhead. Well, people started showing up with everything but the goat. And I started saying, now, wait a minute. You know, I'm not going to give this prize, which was no more than a record album, to anybody unless they got the goat. There again, it captured the imagination of the town. And, of course, that was a Florida State town. So, you know, there was a lot of young people. To make a long story short, I stayed on the air until 1 o'clock because we got a call from a fraternity that they had a goat and they were bringing it to the drive-in. And once again, people went crazy. They came to the drive-in to see these kids bring a goat. I mean, that was all. They were just going to bring a goat, a billy goat. And they did. And once again, they had to get traffic control and everything else because the drive-in was swamped. I mean, just swamped. All to come see a billy goat.
How had radio changed from the time that you originally worked at WTMA to the second time you worked there?
One thing that had changed by then, we were starting to see the use of cartridges instead of disc recording.
The second time that you were at TMA, who were some of the voices and personnel at the time?
You know, I don't remember them.
Because you were out at the drive-in?
Yeah, I knew them. I don't mean to suggest that I was stuck up or anything like that. I just didn't come in contact with many of the other on-air personnel. Didn't do many commercials for TMA back then. Later, when I was at Woke and other stations, I did a lot of commercials, a lot of production stuff then.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot for Woke. I left TMA then, went back to Woke, as a matter of fact, and worked there for maybe 2 years, I guess. I guess I sort of outgrew popular music, top 40 music or whatever it is. I'm not sure.
So at that time, WOKE was playing popular music, top 40 music. They weren't actually
time,
playing the old fogey music that they
That's right. Wonderful
play later.
Woke Radio decided they would try to compete with TMA. And they did a fairly decent job of it. They really didn't have the power to knock TMA off in terms of the number one radio station in Charleston. But they did a pretty good job. Anyway, I guess I got tired of that music and decided I wanted to do something more. And I went to work for WNCG Radio and set up the first radio news department in Charleston.
And WNCG is 910.
That's correct. This station that is now WTMZ was WNCG.
That would be around 1960, I know, when the station came on the air. Was that about the time
you were
there? Yeah,
that was 1963, I think, or two, something like that, that I started that news department. I told Ansley Cohen, the then owner of NCG, that I could set up a live news operation with a news car, two-way radios, and a lot of time. So that's what we did.
So before that time, there was really no local radio news in Charleston?
No, all the news on radio in Charleston back then was rip and read.
Straight off the Associated Press and UPI wire machines?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even the local stuff?
That's correct. If it didn't appear on the teletype, it wasn't going to be read on radio in Charleston. No one was doing that, to my knowledge, unless something really big required it. But otherwise,
so nobody
was strictly
bothering to pick up the paper and rewrite the local stories?
No. That's one of the things I did at NCG. I did take some stories from the newspaper, but by and large, anything they covered, I was covering live. I was there and chasing it, digging it out. I had news rounds. I went to people and told them, look, I'm a newsman in Charleston. I need to know what's going on. Will you tell me? and they were kind enough to do so. And I competed with the newspaper. I whipped them, too, a number of times. They'll admit that.
Just as WTMA is whipping them nowadays sometimes.
I think so, yeah.
So how long were you at WNCG?
Only 3 years, and then I left them and went to work for Senator Fritz Hollings, and worked for him for a couple of years as his what they called home secretary. And then Channel 2 lost their news director, Ed Webb, and they came to me and asked me if I'd come to work for them as their news director. So that's how I ended up in television. And that's where I stayed for the next 12 years.
What was WNCG doing music-wise when you were doing
good
the
music.
News there?
Good music. Yeah.
What WTMZ is doing today.
That's right. Yeah.
It's come full circle.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you notice that any of the other radio stations, because you were doing news at WNCG, decided, hey, this might be a good idea to actually...
Three of them, including WTMA.
Get a local news department?
They got a local news department. One of their news directors is still a very good friend of mine, Wayne Long. He went to work for the country music station, and I'm sorry, I can't recall those call letters.
WQSN?
QSN, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was a news director over there. And then he worked for me at Channel 2 for a little while, doing my 11 o'clock news. All the radio stations tried to compete. I say all three, the three bigger stations, TMA, NCG, and WCSC Radio, tried to compete with me. But Wayne did a pretty good job staying with me. The rest never really caught up because we really had a big jump on them.
You would think that WCSC Radio, since they had a TV station there, would have had the advantage since they had the TV news department to pull from.
Well, you'd think so, but their approach to news was different from mine. My approach was that my community is listening to me, and this was true in radio and it was true in television. My community is listening to me and depending on me to tell them what happened today, what's going on in their community. Good, bad, or indifferent didn't matter. I was going to tell them. If they liked it, fine. If they didn't like it, that's all right, too. But they're going to know it. I'm going to tell them.
What was a typical day like for you at WNCG when you were a news person?
Started at 5 o'clock in the morning. I did a 7 o'clock news, and then I hustled downtown and started making rounds. Would go to the police stations, all three of them, city, county, and state. And I would go by political contacts I had, people on the waterfront, business leaders, political leaders, people I knew, and people who had a little faith in me that I would not divulge where, you know, who told me about it. And I would dig it out. I'd find out what was going on, whether it was going to be reported in a press release or not. I was going to find it out first. On NCG, and we're talking radio here, so we'll leave television out of it. I was only one man. So my responsibility was to find enough people who would talk to me and tell me what's going on so that I didn't have to try to be everywhere. I had to have people who had enough faith in me, like me enough maybe, to call me and say, hey, Red, did you know so-and-so? That's how I got my news.
Did you take a tape recorder out in the field and tape voices and things off the telephone?
Mm-hmm. I did, and I reported from the scene all the time. That really was the key, was to be on the scene. This was, breaking news, major events. I was on scene, did it live, pure ad lib. Of course, I had a scheduled newscast at 12 o'clock and a scheduled newscast at 6 o'clock. Both of those were 15-minute newscasts, which doesn't sound like much time, but it's an awful lot of time when you've got to get there, get to the radio station early enough to type it up, to read it, and, have it ready by 6 o'clock. So, I'd be on the street as long as I could, and then I would get to the radio station, type the news up, and then get on the air and report it.
So you had a pretty full day.
Yeah, it was a full day, but I loved it. My God, it was more fun. You can't imagine. You were where the action was, when the action was. It was exciting, sometimes dangerous, but it was always fun.
Going back to WTMA, what was a typical day like for you the second time you worked at WTMA, the drive-in thing?
Come in the afternoon, get the music ready, pull out whatever commercials I was going to use. Then I headed for the Target. It seems to me I had to be there at 6 o'clock. And then I went on the air, I think, like 7, but I'm not sure. Stayed on the air till midnight.
Was WTMA a 24-hour station then?
No.
They signed off the air at midnight?
They signed off. They were licensed to stay on, but they did not.
Let's ask about the music at WTMA at the time. Since we don't have any tapes from that era, was all the music during the day, maybe in the 50s, was it all white artists? Did they try not to play any black artists, or did they mix those
in? There was never any avoidance of black artists or white artists. If a record was a hit, it was a hit. It didn't make any difference. Didn't make a particle bit of difference.
So you were on the radio when Elvis hit, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Well, you couldn't play enough of him, I can tell you that. The adults sort of, they had a big thing about the wiggling hips and all of that sort of thing, but the young people, they wanted to hear Elvis. And Pat Boone and all that crap. Fats Domino was hot. You could not play Fats Domino walking to New Orleans often enough. I mean, they just loved it. There was never any deliberate effort to avoid black artists. In fact, as they produced more and more records that were hits, we played them. Didn't make a difference to us. What the kids wanted to hear, and so we were going to play them.
When you were a DJ, did you decide what songs to play?
Yeah. Our records were 45s, you know, the 45 RPM records. This is kind of cute. I learned to be an expert on the color of the label, because you could have a stack of 50 or 75 45 RPM records in front of you. If you kinked them to the side and looked down through the hole in the 45 RPM record, you could see the colors that you wanted. And if it was a Columbia record, which back then was yellow, you could look down in all the yellow records, you could flip to see if that's the one you wanted. That's how you found the record. So I got pretty good about knowing what color that label was going to be. So Fats Domino was on Dot Records, and it was a black label. So I could look down through that hole and see the label.
Today, you have a program director at radio station that tells the disc jockey what to play and when to play it. What was the program director's job back then, if you got
Basically the same music? Basically the same thing, yeah. I was program director at a station in Spartanburg. I controlled what we played. We played Top 40. And if a record didn't fall in that category, in my judgment, we didn't play. Of course, I would get arguments from the disc jockeys. They wanted to play it for one reason or another. Maybe they liked it. Maybe they thought it would be a hit. Whatever. But, yeah, we had the same thing.
We've heard a lot about Plugola and Payola back in the 50s. Did you have any encounters with that?
Well, only to the extent that I got a cigarette lighter from Capitol Records.
Nobody showed up on the doorstep at your radio station and said, here's $50, please play this song?
I can't say that ever happened. I can say that we broke a big hit record, the Conway Twitty's first hit, Make Believe.
Wow.
We called him Maverick. That was when the Maverick series was hot on television.
Mm-hmm.
So we called him Maverick. We didn't think anybody would buy a record by a fellow named Conway Twitty. I mean, that just didn't seem possible. So we called him Maverick. And the record stores were going crazy because people were calling in and asking for Maverick. Didn't have it. They didn't know what they were talking about. So we called MGM Records and told them that they had a hit on their hands with Conway Twitty. The A&R man said, well, you know, we're getting some sales out of Cleveland, but what do you mean? And I told him, I said, well, we called him Maverick and the record's going wild here in Tallahassee, Florida. So I don't know how they dealt with that, but somehow he became a big hit.
What about promotions at WTMA or WOKE in Charleston? Do you remember anything in specific that you all did?
We did the usual same kind of promotions that you all are doing now. Nothing has changed in that regard. We did some big promotions in Florida. We had some promotions at WOKE and TMA too, but they were mostly simple contests. Nothing earth-shattering. Nothing
identify
like
this artist, call in and win,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah, same thing. Third caller to identify this artist is going to win a record album or two tickets to a movie or whatever it was. And I did a lot of that sort of thing at the drive-in restaurant, too. You know, you get a free chicken dinner if you recognize this artist, that kind of thing.
Now, WTMA was also simulcast on FM back in the 50s.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody listen on the FM, or was that pretty much ignored?
I don't think it was ignored as much as we thought back then. I really don't. I thought for years that it was. And then I later learned that maybe it wasn't as ignored as I thought.
Well, they simulcast until, I believe, the 70s when it became WPXI. And then later became 95SX, which it is today.
Well, see, by that time I was in television news, and my interest in the disc jockey side of the of radio had pretty much waned. So I lost track of all of that.
So how long were you at Channel 2?
Until 1978.
And then what'd you do after that?
Went to Washington, worked for...
D.C.?
Washington, D.C. Worked for a congressman for a couple of years, and then went to work for a management organization of federal employees. And I lobbied the Congress and what have you for the next 15 years. So I spent 15 years up there, and then I retired in 93.
Red Evans passed away in 2008 at the age of 75. But he will be fondly remembered for his years of broadcasting in the Charleston market, including his time at WTMA.
The history of TMA continues next on 1250 WTMA.
WTMA. I'm John Quincy, and you're listening to the history of TMA.
That's Ann Murray's Low Song, Hit Bell, from WTMA, 1140 with Billy Smith, as we listen to a strange sound.
Oh, yeah. Oh, some of that good Motown magic. 1967, Diana Ross and the Supremes and Reflection.
Next, Billy Smith, a DJ who was here.
It was like 72 through about 74, 75.
All right. Where were you before you came to TMA?
I was at WFLB in Fayetteville.
And how long had you been in radio at that point?
Oh, Lord. it. I started about 1959-60, my hometown station, and left there. You know, went to a couple of little small stations, WDAR, Darlington, a few others. Anyway, WTGR, Tiger Radio, Myrtle Beach, was really the station I wanted to be because I love the beach. I always loved the ocean. I was a little boy, so I never had any really aspirations to go to big cities. I had a couple of offers, but I was just happy here living by the Atlantic Ocean.
So coming to TMA was a big deal for you, huh?
That was it, yeah. You know, when I was a little boy, I'd listen to WTMA, and I said, man, this is big-time radio. One day I'm going to work there. And plus, I love Charleston, too.
Who was the guy that hired you at TMA?
John Trenton.
And what shift did you work there?
I started out 9 till noon. I said, man, I got it made. I do a 3-hour shift. Of course, I had to be there till 5, you know, to do production. You just had to be there, but 9 till 12 on the air.
So what was John like to work for?
He was a good guy. He was very professional. But, you know, he had his standards. He had his way. He wanted it done. And that was it. He had a big note up one time. Said, remember, the music is the star, not you.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, I was a little, you know, when I first went there, because I was one of these DJs that when I first started, sound effects, doing gimmicks and doing bits, you know, and that was my style. And that's why I thought I was hired. Then I got there, and he said, no, it's time temperature. So I was a little disappointed at first, but I got it, you know, WTMA time, you know, did the time temperature robot type stuff.
So was he doing mornings at that time before
yes,
you?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Okay. Was he doing mornings the whole time you were there?
I think he quit for maybe a couple months, but his ratings, he always had great ratings. And so he left the morning show to become the general manager of the station. But then the ratings went down, so he went back on the morning show and was still the manager of the station.
And who was the program director when John left?
A guy named John Scott.
That was J.J. Scott?
J.J. Scott. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, J.J. Everything had to have Trenton's approval before J.J. could do it.
Who were some of the other guys that you worked with when you first came to TMA?
Let's see, it was Keith Nichols, Steve Russell. Steve Russell's a good guy. Gosh, of course, there was Ted Bell, Booby, the big boob, Booby Nash. And Booby, he was probably my best friend at the station. We were big party buddies, big party buddies. And we partied a lot. Booby and I, we were pals. Like I say, we were together at least every other day. We'd go out and knock back a few or more. John Trenton and I, as a matter of fact, John and Booby and I, we'd have parties like every Friday night at, one of the other houses, either mine or John's or Booby's. So John was a good party guy, too. He liked to slug back a few.
Yeah.
So that's what I remember mostly, just having a good time. Like on the weekends, we were always together. Sometimes John, but mostly Booby and I.
That's pretty cool, hanging out with the people you work with.
Yeah, yes it is.
Now, WTMA was the top station in town at the time, right?
Yes, it was, yeah.
How did that make you feel? Did you get a lot of vibe off the audience? I mean, was that really cool, being there at the number one station?
Oh, it was great. Like I say, TMA was my station when I was a little boy. And I would just sit there sometimes, you know, just look at the program logs. It says WTMA. I said, here I am. Right here on the Ashley River in the beautiful city of Charleston, having a good time. I loved it.
So why'd you leave?
I think probably my wife and I got divorced. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to get back to the beach, clear my head a little bit. But I had all intentions of going back, but I came back to the old ocean and stayed. Went back to Tiger Radio, WTGR.
So you've been in Myrtle Beach ever since?
Yeah.
Why do you think WTMA was such a popular radio station in the 70s when you were here?
Back to when they started, back in the late 50s. You know, WTMA always had that New York big city sound. It was one of the few stations that had actual, you know, the singing jingles, which were really unheard of, the little small stations, you know, that I grew up with. And so to hear WTMA, it was like big-time radio back in the 50s. George Wilson was the guy. Was Deputy Doug Randall.
Yeah, Doug Randall, Bill Walton was there, too.
Bill Walton, right. He was the 9 to noon guy. George would do 6 to 9, and then come back noon to 3. Is that right?
That's what I hear, yeah.
And
it was just
like
three guys.
Bill, who would do 9 to noon, come back 3 to 6, and then I think Doug Randall did 6 to midnight. But that's the way the shifts were back then. You always had your double shifts.
Can you imagine that today?
Oh, man. If I had to go back at 3 o'clock today, I think I'd give me a job at the Scotchman down the street.
What about listening to WTMA as a kid? What do you remember about the radio station?
Like I say, you know, I love the music, of course, but the fact that George Wilson was such a personality, we had a small-town radio, and you guys would mostly talk like this here. Well, it's 67 degrees, and we'll have a high today about 74, going to be up there about 74. You know, you listen to these guys like straight country, and then you got like George Wilson, who was like, you know, somebody sounds like he's out of New York or something. And it's just, I go back to that phrase that I've worn out, but it was just strictly big-time radio. That's the way it sounded. And just coming out of Charleston, it made you think of, you know, the skyline of Charleston going over the big bridge. Was it the Cooper River?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Cooper River Bridge, just driving over, seeing the Charleston skyline. And that's the way the radio station sounded, had that big city power behind it.
How would you sum up your time at WTMA?
It was good. It was good. Like I said, I didn't particularly like being so strictly formatted. I wish I could have had a little more freedom. And I think it would have gone over in Charleston. Because most of the radio they had was like, I can't think of any before, you know, George Wilson, Deputy Doug, really any big radio personality. I mean, like John Trenton was a good name. Booby Nash was a big name. But I think it could have been more.
Well, wasn't Booby Nash at the time doing more personality stuff at night?
I think he was, yeah. So they stopped him. By the time I got there, he had to follow the format. And he was funny, always a witty guy, you know. Well, I relied on sound effects and bits. He could just, you know, just be on there, just do a record intro and sound great. You'd be funny.
Well, I guess that cut down on your show prep time. Doing
yeah,
time and
right,
tip.
Yeah. Oh, they picked out your oldies for you. Another thing I didn't like is I love playing my own oldies. So you'd go in every morning at your desk. They'd have your, played like, I think, 4 or 5 oldies an hour. They'd have your, like, 20 oldies, however many you needed, on your desk in the order you played them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was strict when I think about it.
WTMA, that's Al Green, and I am living for you.
Love you, love you, love you, baby. Come in.
11:34. Oh, Thursday morning, a little foggy out there. If you're on the road, please drive carefully.
I remember when Mary Lou said you want to walk me home from school.
Thanks to Billy Smith for his WTMA memories. We'll move on to the early 80s next as the history of TMA rolls on.
You are listening to the history of TMA. With more, here's Charleston radio historian John Quincy.
WTMA! Charleston.
Welcome back. This hour on the history of TMA, we're spending time with some of the past air personalities from our station's music radio days, like Morning Man Paul Mayer.
You were at WTMA in Charleston when exactly?
Well, let's see now. That would have been the fall of 1980.
And where were you before you were at WTMA?
I was in Memphis at WHBQ.
And why did you come to TMA from HBQ?
Rick Dees left HBQ to go play out in California, and I was doing nights there, and they asked me to do mornings. So I did mornings for a while, and the competitive situation in Memphis was a little odd. So I was looking to get more into the management end of the broadcast biz, and so I was offered a job there to be operations manager and do mornings same time, which is a fate worse than death.
Yeah, really.
That's a real tough combination. You're always there. That means you just sleep in the control room.
Even when you're not there, you're there.
You're there. You're always there. Yeah, your spirit's there. Not that your spirit does a lot of work. You can bet your butt you're always going to be in the studio somewhere. One morning I got there at 5 o'clock, and I mean, this is a horribly run-down place. And it was way down the end of that road. Orange Grove Road?
Orange Grove Road, yes.
I guessed it after all these years. Okay. It was all the way down the end of that road, almost on the water. You could hardly see the building from the road because they had like 2 or 3 dumpsters out front. You had to park next to the dumpsters. But I got there quite early in the morning when I did mornings. I went on the air at 5:30, so I would get there like 3:30. And I got there one morning and got out of my car and started walking towards the building. And I heard something behind that dumpster rustling around. And I thought, there's somebody back there. And the guy who did overnights, his name was Mike Green, who I had hired from Jacksonville. He ran a limousine service or something later, years later. Anyway, Mike did overnights, and I thought he was out there pulling some kind of prank on me or something. So I thought, it's got to be him. He's back there goofing on me or something, because you know? He knew what time I got there every morning. Well, I came around the corner of the dumpster, and I was wrong. Here was this, like, of course, now I'm talking from the eyes of terror here. Here was this gigantic 400-foot rabid raccoon. And this thing came out after me on its hind legs. Well, I'm kind of a big guy, but that big guy could move pretty damn fast that morning. This thing came after me and came all the way up to the door of the building. I couldn't get my keys out fast enough. I thought, I'm going to die. I'm going to be bitten and eaten alive by the raccoons out here in the dumpster. This thing and all its family are hiding out here, and they couldn't find enough surplus, you know, dumpster dining. They're going to put my butt on a spit. And it's going to be Bessinger's Barbecue right here. I'm a dead man. Well, the next morning when I pulled up there, I had a company car, except when the owner was in town, and then he had to use it. That was another thing that ticked me off. I was part of the deal when I got there was that I'd have a company car. Well, you know, in most businesses, when you're given a company car, then you have your own car. Well, when the owner came to town, then he used my car. Well, I didn't have a car then, you know, so that was a real drag. Oh, my God, here's the boss without a car. That was a wonderful image to portray to the staff. So, anyway, I pull up in this car, and it was like a blue Camaro, or so it was a sports car. It was a really nice-looking vehicle. And I'd pull up to that dumpster, and I'd bump it with that big bumper, you know, boom, you know, just to scare the hell out of the life that was in there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And things would come flying out of it. And I'd wait 10 minutes, then I'd get out of the car and go back in. But after that run-in with Rocky Raccoon, that was about it for me.
So you answered an ad in one of the trade magazines and came to WTMA? Is that how
that
worked?
No, not really. They'd just been sold, I guess, at that time to Sconics.
And the people at Sconix brought in a new general manager, and the new general manager brought in a new consultant, and the consultant was a friend of mine. He brought me in.
Who was the consultant? Do you remember?
John Long. John had previously been the program director in Memphis. I don't know. It's a radio is kind of a business where quite often one thing is said and the other thing is done. The whole game plan was that there were two radio stations in the building at the time, TMA and... Oh, boy, I want to say...
WPXI.
PXI, there you go, which later became SX, which I, by the way, am the guy that picked out the call letters for that radio station.
Oh, really?
That's correct. But anyway, people have to go way back in their head to remember that at that time is when FM was really coming to prominence, and a lot of AM stations were really suffering in the music business. As far as music radio goes, it was very hard to compete with, you know, FM stereo and so on. WTMA at that time was going to be an adult contemporary station aimed at those middle-aged folks who are kind of like office listening and so on. But we were really having a hard time competing as an AM. There was some signal trouble. There was also another station in town was the big gun at that time. So the best way to compete with that was to somehow get WTMA on FM. And the game plan was on the January 1st of 81, they were going to switch the old patch cords there, and that PXI, that was going to go to the AM frequency, and TMA was going to go FM. I was brought in there specifically for that purpose. 2 weeks prior to that happening, the ownership decided, oh, we don't want to play that game. Let's do something else. That's when they decided, well, we're just going to leave TMA the way it is on the AM at that time. And that's when the SX station was born.
Were you disappointed about that?
Yes, I think so. I had just moved there and moved friends of mine into positions there. Tad Griffin, I guess his name there was Jay Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with him in Memphis, and he was in Kansas at the time, and I brought him in because he's an excellent production wizard and could make a magical commercial happen out of the midair. Made some major changes in the staff and so on, and the whole thing just bottomed out, and I was very disappointed in it, especially in the fact that nobody knew anything about it. It was just the owners, you know, they have the right, their toy, so they want to play with it, they can, and they did. Fortunately for them, it became a very successful FM station. TMA, I think, at that time, didn't do very well as an AM adult contemporary station. You know, it was just continuing to go downhill as the AMs did at that time, but were trying to play music. That was just the trend of radio at that time. So, very frustrated with the situation, I said, well, this isn't going to work out for me. The station across the street, KTM, just prior to the announcement of this change that wasn't going to happen, had hired another friend of mine, a previous co-worker, as program director, a fellow by the name of Paul Sebastian. So when Paul came to town, he and I, of course, talked on the phone, and I was telling him about the frustration I was going through, and he said, well, why don't you come over here and work here? So I did, like in a matter of minutes. When the TMA thing fell through, then I went over to work for KTM.
So how long do you think that you were at TMA the whole time?
I think that was only a period of like September or October until January.
So just a few months.
Yeah, just a few months, yeah. Then I was at KTM for a while. I don't remember how long that lasted. That didn't last a whole lot of time because Sebastian left shortly after that, and that was also a place that was in flux, as they say. There were a lot of changes going on there, and that just didn't seem to work out very well, and in kind of an unusual situation. I was getting really upset with the radio business at the time and was getting kind of frustrated with it. But, you know, I had a family that seems to want to eat, so I took a job with a basically automated station that was AM, and it played big band music. And I went to work there partly to keep some kind of income.
And what town was this in?
That was in Charleston. That was the strangest little radio station.
Was this at 1450 WQSN?
Yes, it was, because it was something that the callers were like U.S. Navy or something. Their studio was located in this old house.
Mm-hmm, that's the one.
And it sat on stilts over a creek. And the building wasn't in the greatest condition, and you'd sit in the control room there and play radio. And, of course, the image you're giving out over the air is that you're in a lavish, wonderful, warm studio or whatever. And, in fact, you'd turn around, and crabs would be walking across the floor. They'd come up those piers, and they'd come in. There were holes in the floor. That was a different place. Shortly after that, I ran into a personal situation where my parents had gotten ill, and I left the radio biz for a while and went and helped out my parents with their business. And then I got back into it in Baltimore. I worked at the number one top 40 station there for a while, part-time, while I was running my parents' dry cleaning business.
What were the call letters?
B104.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
WBSB. And I worked there part-time for a while, and then I did afternoons on WMIX, or WWMX, which was technically the call letters. I did afternoons there and the Saturday night oldies show, and that was a lot of fun. I did that until 1991, and another ghost crossed my path. Another person from the radio biz in Memphis invited me to come down there. I still wanted to get into programming again, but the problem was that when I got out of radio after Charleston, I'd gotten too far out of the loop. And that's when radio went through a lot of changes. You know, it became computerized, and computerized music logs, and all those things evolved, and I wasn't there when that happened. And so I was really behind the behind, you know? So I wanted to get back into programming or something. And so I went to Florence, Alabama, and worked for a station there for about a year. It was owned by Sam Phillips, the guy, you know, that put Elvis together on Sun Records. He was based out of Memphis, but he owned a station in Florence, Alabama. And I did that for about a year, and then I got a deal where I could be part ownership with a radio station that, again, involved John Long. And this was in Augusta, Georgia. So we moved to Augusta, Georgia.
Which station in Augusta was that?
Well, it was a little station called AGA, I believe. It didn't last very long. We got there. It was a deal where John was going to manage it. This was going to be one of the first totally computerized automated radio stations. I was going to handle the programming end of it. He was going to do the management and sales and so on. We got it off the ground, and it started to do fairly well. It was kind of a light AC format.
FM?
Yeah, oh yeah. And it was only a 6,000 watt, but they could get an increase to 25. We were actually in a little town of Waynesboro, Georgia, which is like 20 miles or so south of Augusta. And with that power increase, we would have covered the whole market. So that finally came through, but at the time it came through, the guy who was financing the whole deal decided he didn't want any more to do with it. He didn't know anything about radio. He was just a financial backer, and so he backed out, and the whole thing kind of fell apart, and we ended up having to sell the station off. And so I went to work for a country station.
GUS?
My wife went to work for them, the company that owned that. That was Benchmark, I believe, at the time. I went to work for KXC, Kix 99, and I did that for, that was from 92 through 95. And then in 95, I got the offer to come here where I am in Maryland, which I actually technically Delaware. This was a group of stations where they had a, it's kind of an odd market in the fact that it's very seasonal. It's on the beach, you know, so in the winter time there's no business here. You know, in the summer, everybody has to make all their money with the tourists, and or you die for the rest of the year. Anyway, it was a unique situation. It was a country station again, and it was an operation manager deal. So I came up here and did this for about 2 or 3 months when I realized that, again, I'd been promised something that wasn't going to happen. So I said, the heck with it. I'm done with radio. Good night, everybody. See ya. I'm leaving stage left. And I took off, and shortly after that, got in, did some advertising work and did commercials and things like that. But as you know, that's like riding the roller coaster from hell. So I didn't do that very long, and I decided to do something that I thought about ever since I was a little kid, and that is real estate, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Thanks, Paul. We'll be talking to another WTMA DJ of the 80s coming up next on the History of TMA.
The History of TMA.
WTMA, mighty TMA.
You're listening to the History of TMA.
Now, let's hear from Charlie McGraw, who worked at WTMA. When, Charlie?
It was 81, actually. Kind of hard for me to remember. You know, I'm getting too old and my memory's gone. But I do have some fond memories of the station. Even before that, it's kind of special for me to have worked at TMA. I grew up and went to high school in Somerville, down the street from Charleston. So I grew up listening to the Big Boob, Boobie Nash, and those guys. So when I had a chance to work at the station, it was something real special to me, having grown up listening to those guys.
Now, WTMA wasn't your first radio job, was it?
No. Actually, my first radio job was in Louisville, Kentucky at Wacky Radio, 79 WAKY.
Oh, great radio station.
Yeah.
Great radio station.
Yeah, that's where I got started. And moved out here to Las Vegas at a little AM station, country back then, and been here pretty much ever since, except for a little stint in Columbus, Ohio at WNCI.
All right, now, what prompted you to come to Charleston to WTMA?
Actually, my dad was ill. I was in radio out here at the time, and it was a little station called KRAM, and my dad wasn't doing well, so I moved back down to Somerville, spend some time with him, and ended up getting a gig there. Craig Erickson hired me there as a PD, and taught me a lot. I really sucked.
So you were doing nights at TMA?
Yeah, and the specialty show, we, you know, kind of brought back the old jingles, the Mighty TMA, and spun some beach music disc, and it was a lot of fun.
Now, going back a little bit, from somebody who grew up in the area, what did WTMA mean to you? You listened to Boobie Nash, you mentioned.
That was the station back then. I mean, everybody. I mean, headed toward Folly Beach, you know, you cranked up in the morning Boobie Nash, and hey, the big boob. Loved, I tell you what, he was my hero when I was a kid. Never had intentions of getting into radio, by the way, either. Just kind of by accident, I actually moved next door to the guy Gary Burbank up in Louisville, Kentucky, and I used to do characters with him. And he goes, "Hey, man, you ought to get in radio." You know, so they ended up giving me a chance to, you know, play in Casey Kasem and stuff like that on the weekends. And I sold industrial tooling products on the side. It was a lot of fun. And then finally, McVeigh says, "Hey, man, you want to move out to Vegas? I get you a job on an AM." Yeah, so I took off, got a divorce. You know, the whole thing with the radio, you get a divorce and move out of town.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I had my first gig, full-time gig, actually out here. So that was 79, so it was a great time.
What do you remember about WTMA the time you were here in 1981? I guess by that time it had transformed into an adult contemporary station after being a top 40 station for many years.
Yeah, pretty much, except for the point where, you know, I did the Mighty TMA oldies show. It was the Tams, and if you remember those names from around Folly Beach.
Mm-hmm.
So mine was a little different than, I guess, everybody else's shift, and I did some fill-ins. And great story. And I don't know if you remember this or you were there, and I believe it had to be on the weekend. I was on the air, and all of a sudden I thought, you know, I kind of smell smoke back here a little bit. What the hell is that? About that time, three firemen, full gear with hatchets, axes, ran by the studio window. I thought, oh, my God, there's a fire. I didn't know what to do. You know, I said, I've got a two-minute record on here, and I'm going to burn up, but what am I going to do? I can't leave the record. So I stayed in. I stayed on the air for the entire time. They put the fire out. I guess it was an electrical fire in the back, and the studio's full of smoke, and I'm standing there spinning records like an idiot.
Oh, you're a trooper, a true broadcast professional, going down with the ship.
I thought I'd get fired if I left, so either way, I was fired, you know. That's a sick joke, wasn't it? On a sour note, the GM at the time, we had some network problems with, I guess, the audio. Comes running into the studio, you know, just throws his arm out and shoves me aside. I'm a big guy, you know, so for him to do it, well, so is he. And when I told Craig, I said, look, tell him not to do that. You know, don't touch me, please. And about 4 days later, here he comes, running again, you know, shoves me aside. So I yank my headsets out, and I said, CJ, you got the helm there, buddy. Toward the end of the shift, anyhow, so I just walked out and got in my car and drove away.
Oh, that was your last day at WTMA.
That was my last day at WTMA. It was kind of a sad note to have to do it that way, but it was kind of funny. I finally got out of the business and pretty much stayed in broadcasting, but having fun out here running a TV station for the city of Las Vegas and our mob attorney lawyer, or mayor, so he's a great guy.
So Las Vegas, that's, I guess, your second home, huh?
Yes, it is. You know, I've been out here ever since, you know, then, for a year before I went back and worked at TMA and came back out here. Been here pretty much ever since, except for about a year or so in Columbus, Ohio, at WNCI. So.
Besides CJ and Craig Erickson, any other folks that you remember from WTMA that you work with?
You know, I'm sad to say that I don't. I was pretty much a loner myself. Went there, did my radio show pretty much, talked to you guys in the hallways every once in a while. But
yeah, we had the pleasure of working together. I was working at 95SX doing the afternoon show, so I saw you every day. I think I worked till 8 o'clock every night.
Yeah, you were there quite a bit. And it's amazing that you were around there that long. I mean, such a great guy. Usually nice guys don't make it, you know?
Well, I guess if you can make it in Charleston, you can make it anywhere.
The market at the time, you know, SX was the big station, and I think went on to become even bigger, if I can recall, you know, the FM stations. Poor AM stations, man. We, you know, we were a sign of the times, and FM was just such a magnitude of force as far as broadcasting goes that it was kind of sad to see, you know, TMA go from what it used to be when I was a kid growing up. I was kind of heartbroken it was AC, to be honest with you, you know, simply because it was beach music and top 40 when I was a kid, and then all of a sudden you get there and they're playing Barry Manilow, man, come on. But I enjoyed it, and the marketplace, you know, I don't remember that much about the competition at the time. We were our own entity, kind of struggling along, doing what we could do to stay on the air, so SX was the piece.
We hope you've enjoyed this hour of the history of TMA. I'm John Quincy, and if you'd like to learn more about WTMA's legacy, surf to WTMAMemories.com. There you can download rare audio broadcasts See what many of the people you heard on the radio really looked like. Read stories about the station and more. That's WTMAMemories.com. And keep that dial locked on the radio station that continues to make history, as well as report it as it happens. 1250 WTMA.